God give us roses as we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits knew. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater days. The rising of the women means the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler, 'tis that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses.
Welcome, fellow plebs. My name is Sean, and this is
Tribunus Plebis.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 18 of the Tribunus Plebis podcast. Today, I am going to talk to you folks about something that happened a long time ago in a city not too far from my own. But before I do that, I want to preface this whole episode with something. This episode was very hard to do, much harder than I expected it to be. I actually recorded the entire thing once before and had to scrap it because it didn't come out as well as I would have liked it to. Part of that is the subject matter. The first, 5 to 8 minutes or so are particularly bleak and perhaps even a little bit dry. And it's all because I talk about the history and hardships of the people most directly involved in this story. But I believe that the history and the conditions of life in turn of the century Lawrence, Massachusetts is very much important to understand as we move forward. In fact, I would go so far as to say it is the key to the entire thing. Unfortunately, that history and those conditions are kind of cheerless because what we are really talking about here is real, actual human misery. It is a misery derived from two primary causes: the avarice and greed of private enterprise and the tyranny of government. Making it doubly sad is that it was this way because of conscious choices. Now, perhaps a better storyteller could interweave these facts of life throughout the main body of this podcast and not lose the narrative. But I can't. And after reflecting on it for a while, I'm not even sure that I would really want to. What I do want is for my listeners to really understand the base reality that existed in a turn-of-the-century mill town before we get to the exciting stuff, because I believe that this understanding will make the story that much more real for you. And that reality is not a bunch of happy little poor people content with their life. The reality is, as reality often is, rather more dark than that. So please bear with me for the first 5 minutes or so of this podcast as we set the stage for the action scenes which will follow. The first thing I want to do is roll back in time a little bit and look at a few things to help frame where we are as 1911 turns to 1912 and that soon-to-be-fateful January payday. Let's look at Lawrence first, the great mill city of Massachusetts. Lawrence was an industrial city which had been planned, purchased, and built by private industry. And because of that origin story, the town was also controlled by these same private interests, and it had really only rounded into form after 1850. The mills in and around Lawrence, using an artificial canal and dam to harness the power of the Merrimack River, employed nearly 40,000 workers, mostly women, and most of these women could be more fairly referred to as girls as they ranged in age from 13 to 19 years of age. Blocks and blocks of tenement buildings were relegated to the poor, aka the laborers in those very mills. At the same time, the nicer neighborhoods were the haunts of the mill owners, their families, and their financial backers. Over the next 50 years, the town grew, both industrially and in population. More mills sprang up, and more immigrants moved in for jobs. But as the Industrial Revolution trudged along, more highly paid skilled jobs faded, and they were replaced with steam-driven looms and machinery. The higher paid skilled workers were fired, and they got replaced with lower paid and unskilled labor. Native-born Americans who held those skilled jobs were replaced with a cultural and linguistic hodgepodge of immigrant families and workers who moved into the tiny tenement apartments, often several families per cramped unit. At its height, Lawrence itself produced about 25% of all woven material in the country. And that's not even counting the production of the nearby cities of Lowell and Worcester or any other New England mills. Unsurprisingly, over 52% of all wages in Lawrence were derived directly from these mills. And this is where it begins to get a little dark, but we can get through this together, dear listeners. In the years before our story truly begins, one-third of Lawrence's loom operators would die within 10 years of their first day at work. Half of these workers would never even reach the age of 25. From the book Bread and Roses by Bruce Watson. Quote, "Diseases now easily cured, diarrhea, measles, whooping cough, croup, killed hundreds, most of them children. During the year preceding the strike, 1,524 people died in Lawrence. Almost half were under the age of six, and more than 500 had not yet reached their first birthday." End quote. The mills in Lawrence, and really all of the textile mills throughout New England, most of which were owned or controlled by the American Woolen Company, were filled to the rafters with immigrants or first-generation children of immigrants, most of whom were considered second class, whether because of their immigrant status or just for being of a different ethnicity than the more established groups of Massachusetts. Hungarians, Syrians, Czechs, Polish, and so on worked side by side in those mills, slaving away at the mechanical looms. And those mechanical looms were deadly fast, and so was the pace of work for the ladies who manned them. The highest paid skill positions were held, nearly universally, by native-born Americans or children of the more established immigrant groups of the area, such as the Irish. A few of these people, mostly the skilled workers, were represented by the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, a craft or trade union. Ostensibly, the number of AFL members was into the thousands, but very few actually paid their dues, reducing that number to barely 200 active members. This had led the AFL to declare that the Lawrence and Greater New England textile mills were simply unable to be organized due to the skill divide on one end and the ethnic divisions amongst the unskilled on the other end. Plus a big old hunk of good old-fashioned American bigotry and racism can't be denied here, I think. That racism is made clear in not only the fact that the skilled workers were all native-born, but also that the AFL made only flaccid attempts to make any headway at all with the less desirable, to them, dear listener, not to me, ethnic factions. It was under this brutal status quo that the industrial workers of the world arrived in the city and began their organizing effort around 1901. The IWW, or Wobblies as they are popularly known, were, and still are, a radical trade union that was entirely unsegregated and integrated. But even with that open-mindedness, the Wobblies struggled to get a true toehold in Lawrence, let alone the greater New England textile industry, and they themselves only had 200 to 300 members enrolled by the winter of 1911. The majority of these workers were unskilled and immigrants to this country, divided by country of origin and language amongst even themselves, but divided even more starkly from the few skilled laborers in the mills due to their status as native-born Americans. These women and girls worked in intensely dangerous and trying factories for long hours, very little pay, and absolutely none of what we would call benefits today. The typical week of work for these ladies was 56 hours of work for roughly $7.75, with supervisors making a little more. And that's not $7.75 per hour or per day, but $7.75 per week. The mills were cramped, the buildings stuffed with massive hydro and steam-powered looms, and the atmosphere was hot, damp, and dusty. The inhalation of the dust and fibers from the spinning and weaving left these young women prone to ailments ranging from asthma to tuberculosis, and the perpetual humidity left just as many in constant pain and sickness. And this isn't even to mention the horrific and frequent injuries, both grievous and small, and the constant march of death through those mills. And after that long, dangerous day at work, they would shuffle home to their cramped, decrepit, vermin-infested, overpriced tenement homes. These women, and whatever family they may have had, subsisted primarily on bread and the occasional beans and rice. Meat was a luxury few would ever become accustomed to, as were many vegetables and fruits. And there was perhaps no money left over for beautiful and luxurious things, things like, you know, maybe flowers. Suffice it to say that there were very few or no roses in those Lawrence tenements. As one Lawrence politician noted in his testimony to Congress after the fact, there were two desperately dreamed of luxuries for the poor in Lawrence. One was a little sweet molasses to spread on their bread. The other was, and just wait for this a second, the other desperately dreamed of luxury was water. Yeah, simple water was a luxury to be prayed for in this industrial city of woe. Now, hey, everybody, remember how I said it was going to get rough here? I know it got rough. There's just a little bit more, but you're almost through it, I swear. Just hang with me for another minute or two. Half of the children born to these mill workers would die before the age of 6. A third of all men would be dead before they turned 25 years old. In fact, Lawrence had the 5th highest rate of childhood death in the entire country at the time. The only 4 cities with a higher rate of mortality for children were also textile mill towns, and they were also in Massachusetts. They were Lowell, Worcester, Fall River, and a city that I actually lived in for a few years, Holyoke. And just to be clear about what I just said, the 5 cities in the entire country with the highest rates of childhood mortality were all in Massachusetts, and they were all textile and paper mill towns. And I'm not even sure which of those statistics is worse, to be honest. But we made it. We made it through the slog of badness and are entering the main story, and I appreciate you guys for sticking with me. On January 1st of 1912, a new state law took effect, cutting the workday from 56 to 54 hours per week. Now, in the past, when laws like this had passed, the mill owners had kept the pay the same as before the cuts. But not this year. This year, they decided to cut the pay for these women for those 2 lost hours. But what they didn't do is tell their workers. And because of this lack of communication, the workers began to get nervous and suspect what was likely to happen to them. It was in this morass of desperation and deprivation that a rebellion unfolded that would grab the country's attention and force a reckoning. This rebellion, like so many others, earned itself a name. A name born of the simple desperation and hope of the largely female strikers. As these brave women, and men too, I don't want to entirely leave men out of this because they would play a significant part in this movement, but as the women themselves shut down factories and picketed, they began to rise in defiance and march. And as the women marched, they were said to carry a banner that implored the world for 2 things: sustenance and dignity. The banner they carried read, We want bread and we want roses too. This is the Bread and Roses Strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts in the winter of 1912. As the calendar rolled from 1911 to 1912, the normally harsh and cold New England winter took a turn towards cruel bitterness. Snow and ice littered the towns, and streams and ponds froze over solid. For the first 10 days of the year, union leaders and workers tried in vain to get word from the mills, and also from the American Woolen Company, as to how they planned on handling the new laws in Massachusetts that reduced the work week by 2 hours. The workers were left to wonder whether the owners would continue the previous practice of not cutting wages in such a situation, or would they cut the already meager pay of these destitute workers. The lack of a clear answer and the limbo it created was enough to activate workers all across the city. The first answer received to this all-important and all-consuming question came on January 11th, the first payday of the new year at one particular mill. When a group of Polish women working in the Everett Mill in Lawrence opened their pay envelopes and found themselves short that ever-precious, ever-important 32 cents, they immediately rose up and began shouting with indignation as they shut down their looms. Now, I know that 32 cents doesn't sound like a lot. It's an amount of money which most of us would never even think about if it fell out of our pockets on the bus. But for these families, that meant a loss of important staples like beans and the ever-present loaves of bread. When the mill managers and owners demanded to know why the looms and other machines had stopped running and fallen silent, the response was short and to the point. The workers were no longer being paid enough to continue. Those same workers soon stormed out of the factory shouting, "Short pay, all out." This group of Polish women in the Everett Mill were the first to rise up, but not the last, not by a long shot. But it should be noted that this was not a spur-of-the-moment decision. The unions, both the AFL and the IWW, had been talking to workers for several weeks about what to do if the owners refused to continue paying the workers their full wages. In fact, the evening before, on January 10th, a meeting was held at a place called Ford's Hall, where workers voted to strike if their pay was less than the previous pay period. This was no spur-of-the-moment uprising, but rather the act of a unified labor force. Coming up 32 cents short, or the equivalent of 3 loaves of bread, was the catalyst to the fuel that had been accumulating for months and years. There is only so much indignation and privation that a human being will stand before they say no more. With this decision, the mill owners in New England found that mark. The mill towns all over Massachusetts were buzzing with the actions of the Everett Mill women, but many, and even most, went to their jobs the next day, which was the payday for most of the other mills in the city, and they dutifully manned the machines and looms. But they all knew, in their hearts and souls, what would happen when they opened their own pay envelopes and found that they, too, were short of pay. And when the workers in the rest of the mills did receive those envelopes, they opened them and they found 32 cents missing. They all walked out shouting, "Short pay, all out." But not before a particularly militant band of Italian workers damaged machines, blew fuses, and cut power belts on the way to the door. By the end of the day, on January 12th, over 10,000 workers were on strike and picketing the mills. Within a day, that number swelled to over 15,000, and by the end of the strike, over 30,000 workers were withholding their labor for better pay and treatment. Now, the first thing I want to focus on here is how the unions responded. The Wobblies, the AFL, and the United Textile Workers, the UTW, were all to play a part. The AFL, true to its ideals, were immediately pushing workers to negotiate with the mills in which they worked, and to not negotiate as a unified group with all of the factories, or even with American Woolen itself. Meanwhile, the UTW was actively trying to scuttle the entire strike, and were asserting that they, and nobody else, spoke for the entirety of the Lawrence mill workers. On the third side of this equation, we have the IWW and Joseph Ettore, who would team up with Arturo Giovinatti of the American Socialist Party to actually represent the mill workers by forming a strike committee of 56 people, four each from 14 different nationalities, and they would add to this by printing leaflets in over 20 languages to inform all of the constituents taking part in this labor action. And this is a lesson we could stand to learn again in this country that's allowed itself to be divided by things like race, ethnicity, religion, and immigration status. These divisions are unnatural and pushed on us from those who wield power. At least 14 separate nationalities, many of them in an ostensibly foreign country, but still they remained unified. And not unified within these micro-divisions, but unified as one across all of those divisions, unified by their class and status. Now, the second thing I want to hit on here is how the mill owners and the town itself responded, which, if we are being honest right now, those two forces, the industrialists and the state, were basically the exact same thing. Lawrence was nothing more than an appendage attached to the textile industry, and it was completely run by and ruled over by these same industrialists. The city authorities responded by ringing Lawrence's alarm bells, the first time this had ever been done in its relatively short history, and by calling out both the local police and sending a local militia into the streets. Soon, the mill owners began cruelly turning fire hoses on the picketers in front of their factories, and please remember that this is a brutally cold January in New England. The workers responded by hurling chunks of ice and even bricks at the mills and shattering several windows along the way. Many people were quickly arrested for vandalism, and 24 individuals were sentenced to one full year in prison for breaking windows in that action. An altogether extremely severe punishment for the act, which was justified by the judge as being, quote-unquote, the only way to get a message across to such people. Governor Eugene Foss then sent in state police and state militias in an effort to, as he would say, restore order. But this would soon come to be known for exactly what it was, an act of state terrorism. The following is from an open letter from the strikers to the community. Quote, "We hold that as useful members of society and as wealth producers, we have the right to lead decent and honorable lives, that we ought to have homes and not shacks, that we ought to have clean food and not adulterated food at high prices, that we ought to have clothes suited to the weather and not shoddy garments." End quote. Very quickly, the militias and police joined hired men and leveled their weapons, including clubs and rifles with fixed bayonets, towards the picket lines of strikers that snaked around in front of the mills and throughout the industrial sections of Lawrence. Now, directly into the story steps William Madison Wood, even if briefly. Mr. Wood was the president of American Woolen Companies, which controlled much of the New England textile manufacturing. He was the son of a whaler who was forced at the age of 12 to find work when his father was killed at sea, and he got a job in a mainland textile mill where he was soon promoted into a supervisory position. He then would go off and make a name for himself in finance before coming back to the textile industry. As president of American Woolen, Wood was famed for his expertise in efficiency, that ever-present golden ring of the industrialists and the bane of the American worker. All of that success and expertise did not, however, make Mr. Wood a good man. Shortly after the strikes began, caches of dynamite were discovered throughout the city, and we might take a second here to pause and consider all of those mysterious piles of bricks which seemed to randomly appear in American cities this summer as protests raged. But that was a bit of a digression. That dynamite was initially blamed on strikers and used as evidence of attempted terrorism bad faith, and ill intentions, not to mention the threat of sabotage. But it was shortly discovered that a local undertaker had hidden the dynamite in an attempt to frame the strikers. This undertaker would eventually face a $500 fine for his actions, but the story does not fully stop right there. Now, some of you might be struck with a few questions right now. Stuff like, why would an undertaker do such a thing? Was it politics? Was he just a huge fan of textiles, maybe? Did he just hate the multicultural coalition that had formed in his city? Well, not exactly. It turned out that a certain Mr. Wood, the president of American Woolen, had made a very substantial payment of funds to this undertaker just before the dynamite was placed and discovered. Mr. Wood steadfastly refused to discuss exactly why he had paid this undertaker a large amount of money, even under indictment, or why it so perfectly coincided with this undertaker breaking bad. In the end, Mr. Wood was never seriously investigated nor charged for this rather obvious crime. And that little piece of this larger story is, I think, invaluable to show us what the reality of owning an entire town and its police and judges is truly like. As to the strikers, their primary demands were clear and reasonable. A 15% pay raise, double pay for overtime, and amnesty for anyone involved in the strikes. Clashes between protesters and militias and police were numerous and oftentimes violent. Mass arrests and injuries disrupted worker efforts all across the city. The violent clashes grew more frequent and more dangerous by the hour, and as days passed, bullets and blades were all too frequently used. A young woman joined a protest march the morning of January 29th. To her bosses, she was known as Anna Lopizzo, but to her fellows on Common Street, she was referred to by a different name. To her neighbors, she was Anna LaMonica. Anna LaMonica was a young immigrant girl before the turn of the century, and she was desperate for work to feed herself, and very likely her broader family. So she took a false name to go get it. She spent 20 years working in the mills of Lawrence as Anna Lopizzo for meager scraps, and along the way, she defied the numbers and outlived the expected life of a mill worker. The difference in these names was due to the immigrant community trading and falsifying papers to help each other get jobs in the mills, a practice which the mill owners turned a willing blind eye towards while they tacitly encouraged the act. The papers Anna got to falsify her age had the surname Lopizzo printed on them. So that was who she became for the purposes of work, and that is the name that has fallen down through history as a result. And now, she was fighting for all that had been denied her for those two decades, bread and roses. She, along with hundreds of others, peacefully marched through the streets of Lawrence before being met by a large group of militia and police. As the marchers approached a hastily erected barricade, scuffles ensued. As the scuffles broke into scattered melees, a police commander ordered the militia and police to draw weapons, and they charged the protesters and attacked with clubs, which they swung with abandon. Very quickly, the strikers began to fight back. Shots rang out as multiple police and militia fired into the crowd, Officer Oscar Benoit among them. Benoit's bullet found a target, and very soon Anna Lopizzo lay dead on the ground, murdered by that very bullet, a fact sworn to by 19 different witnesses. A day later, on January 30th, another protest was held, this time a gathering of musicians. This gathering was headlined by a Lebanese contingent, which contained a man named John Ramey, who played the cornet. The protesters played and sang and chanted for about an hour before a contingent of militia arrived. Words were exchanged, and the militia quickly affixed bayonets, lined up, and charged at the unarmed musicians. John Ramey ran. As he ran, he was stabbed through the back with a bayonet and murdered. Two things happened as a result of these deaths. The first is that the mill owners celebrated. They considered this a great victory, and they believed that the strike would soon end due to the loss of life. They believed that the murders would shatter the workers' solidarity and expedite them back to the looms if they took proper advantage of the situation. The second thing that happened is that these same mill owners and authorities took the opportunity to remove the two most significant labor organizers from the field. So, in an effort to discredit the strikers, the authorities decided to frame some people for these deaths rather than take responsibility themselves. They soon found the perfect fall guys, at least from their slanted point of view. Ettore and Giovannitti, the IWW and Socialist Party of America members who had so far been more or less conducting the strike, were quickly arrested for the murder of Anilo Pizzo, despite having been documented as being more than 3 miles away from the scene and giving a public speech during the time of the shooting. A third man, also entirely innocent, having been enjoying dinner at home with his family at the time, was arrested as well, despite having never met either of the two labor organizers. After the deaths and arrests, martial law was declared and the streets were flooded with militia, as all public gatherings were declared illegal. And since public gatherings were prohibited by law, the strikers changed tactics, and instead of mobbing the mill gates, they formed long, marching picket lines that circled in front of the mill gates and even took laps around the entire mill complex where possible. They moved fast, they sang, and they chanted, and they never stopped so as to avoid the letter of the law. As Ettore and Giovannitti were arrested and left a leadership void, Big Bill Haywood, legendary labor man and co-founder of the IWW, along with several others, were sent to the area to begin raising funds for the strikers and the defense of their arrested comrades. The IWW itself began a nationwide collection and began providing much-needed assistance in the form of soup kitchens, stipends, clothing, medical care, and even shelter. It was right around this time that one of the most disgusting and most polarizing events in the entire strike began to unfold. Families fearing for the safety of their children began, with the help of the Wobblies and others sympathetic to the cause, began sending their children to family members or even just foster families which were set up through the union's connections. This is obviously very sad on its face that so many felt that they had to send their children away to make sure that they were safe and even taken care of on such a basic level as being fed and bathed. Several hundred young children would be sent in two waves to New York City, where they were greeted by throngs of union men and women and eventually paraded down Broadway under large signs. Children would also be sent to various other towns around Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont, in particular a town in Vermont called Barre. This event became known as the Exodus of the Children, and it began to sway national public sentiment wholly towards the strikers. And I do want to take a second here to note that this sending of children to live elsewhere wasn't an entirely organic thing. Sending the children away to make sure they were safe and fed was not a lie, but the exodus served another purpose as well. It was a tactic used by unions beforehand, especially in France and Belgium. They used it as a propaganda gambit to help raise awareness for the plight of the workers and garner sympathy. And it worked well in both regards in Lawrence and beyond. In response, and in an effort to stop the public sentiment shift, the Lawrence and state authorities forbid any more children to leave the city. And when a group of families organized a train run to Philadelphia for over 80 of their children, the police decided to prevent it. a defiant group composed almost entirely of women and children arrived at the train station and were met by police as they attempted to board. The mothers, ever defiant in the face of this tyranny and in an effort to save their children, attempted to board the train anyway. What followed was a brazen, cowardly attack by the police as they began to savagely and indiscriminately batter and beat both the women and their children with wooden clubs. Children were picked up and hurled into waiting trucks. Women were beaten onto the ground and dragged by their hair and ankles and tossed into the trucks with the children. One pregnant woman was beaten so badly by the police that she suffered a miscarriage. In all, over 30 women were brutally beaten, arrested, and jailed, many with crying, bruised children cradled in their arms inside of those cells. And none of that is, you know, word of mouth or rumors either. Newspaper reporters were at the train station during the attack and witnessed everything right down to the show trials and imprisonments. And listen, I'd like us all just to take a brief moment here and consider what I've just said. These families wanted to send their children to safety, and the state itself, through the police and the militias, endeavored to prevent parents from saving their children by clubbing the parents and the children with batons and bats before kidnapping and detaining them. Just think about the horror of that. Think about the terroristic nature of it. If we saw that in a movie, we'd be like, nah, they went too far, man. But this was the reality of Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912. The flood of news stories about the exodus of the children began to heavily sway the national opinion about the strikes, but the violent attack on mothers trying to save their babies and children fully kicked the door open, and the entire nation got behind the strikers. Despite all of that pain, the brutal cold of the winter, the lack of food and even heat, the sending away of their children, the deaths and abuse at the hands of the police, and the brutality of the militias, these workers and families stood strong. They turned out every day in massive numbers, day after day, week after week, and they resisted the tyranny of the industrialist tycoons and the tyranny of the state itself through simple defiance. They picketed, they marched in mass, they chanted, and they did it all throughout all of the streets. They endured police brutality on a daily basis, and they persisted. Even the children, after being beaten by the police, participated and held their own demonstrations, where they talked about the hardships of the mills and the tenement buildings crammed together, gutter to gutter, that they lived in, crammed shoulder to shoulder. The attention of the exodus of the children and the brutality of the police in Lawrence was enough to sway not only public sentiment, but also to pressure the mill owners to begin negotiations. On March 1st, the owners proposed a 5% pay raise, which was quickly rejected by the workers. 11 days later, on March 12th, American Woolen Companies, headed by the iniquitous Mr. Wood, conceded to all of the strikers' central demands, a 15% pay raise, increased pay for overtime, and no punishment for strikers. There were a few other concessions as well, including things like modifications to a pay system that drove the workers too hard, too fast, and too dangerously. It had taken over 2 months, but the strikers won their central demands. The victors in this fight were some of the weakest, most powerless groups in the country at the time: women, children, and immigrants. This is something which we should endeavor to never forget, that the weakest of us can defeat the strongest if we unite. There are far, far more of us than there are of them. And now, I'm left here with a few loose ends to tie up in the aftermath of these strikes and the need to address what came next. Joseph Ettore and Arturo Giovannitti remained in prison for much of the next year. The Wobblies continued to raise money for the defense of these two innocent men in and around Boston, until the Boston authorities decided to arrest every member of the defense team in retaliation. The trial itself lasted several weeks and took place in Salem, Massachusetts. A fitting location for a witch hunt of a different era, I suppose. On September 30th of 1912, over 15,000 mill workers in Lawrence, once again called to action, went on strike, this time for a single day. They struck to protest the continued imprisonment of such obviously innocent men. But it would be another 2 months after yet another show trial that the two men were acquitted and released on November 26. Despite the victories of the strike and the drastic shift of public sentiment, not all remained well in the months and years following. Resentments remained, and one of the first casualties happened a few months after the end of the strike when a Lithuanian man named Jonas Smolskas was beaten to death for wearing a union button on his jacket lapel. Federal congressional investigations were begun by President Taft, and the horrors that were told on the stands further swayed public opinion towards the workers in the months that followed. One very brave 14-year-old girl testified about the danger of the machines and told how one of the mechanical looms had torn her scalp off of her head and left her hospitalized for several months after. The victories in Lawrence were hard won, but the victories did not hold. For various reasons, including the IWW's odd reticence to sign union contracts at the time, the mill owners were able to claw back all of the victories won over those 2 months and then to actually manage to drive pay and conditions below where they were in 1912. For his part, Joseph Ettore, one of the men accused of the murder of Anna Lopizzo, continued his work with the Wobblies, leading another strike in 1912 in New York City, this one for unionized waiters, and then another in 1913 for barbers in Brooklyn. In 1916, he became an executive member of the IWW before leaving after a dispute over tactics in a mining strike. Ettore would go on to manage an orchard in California until his death in 1948. Arturo Giovannitti, Ettore's co-defendant, continued his activism and became a published radical poet and playwright. He was paralyzed from the waist down in 1950 and survived until 1959 when he passed away in the Bronx in New York City. Nearly 14 years to the week after the Bread and Roses strike ended, William Wood, former president of American Woolen, was taken for a drive from his retirement home in Florida. After a time, he asked his chauffeur to stop so he could take in the view. Mr. Wood walked away from his car, put a revolver into his mouth, and pulled the trigger. Anna Lopizzo, the woman whose murder the powers that ran Lawrence attempted to frame Giovannitti and Ettore's for, spent 88 years in an unmarked grave until David Morris, an assistant business manager of Electrical Workers Local 2321 in North Andover, Massachusetts, had a headstone made for her. The work was done pro bono by granite workers in Barrie, Vermont, one of the cities which took in children of the strikers during the children's exodus in 1912. The marker was engraved with the symbols of the Bread and Roses strike, stalks of grain, and a rose. It was placed upon her grave, very fittingly, on Labor Day of the year 2000. In the end, while the strike proved that a united working class can and will defeat the industrial capitalists which oppose it, they cannot rest on their laurels. The industrialists surely will not rest, and neither should we. There is a saying that goes something like, "What can be won can be lost," and this is true. This is why we must never, ever consider the fight actually won. There is no time limit here. The battle never stops. It is always being engaged on one side, the side of the industrialists. Workers need to recognize this and dig in and fight back. "We want bread and we want roses too" isn't just a call for better wages. It is a call for basic dignity in quality of life as well. Despite increasing state violence, the workers of Lawrence stood strong, fought back, and remained united in solidarity. Along the way, they showed us one universal truth. If and when we, as the working class, throw our hands into the air, it should never be in exasperation or surrender. It should always be in the form of a fist. Thank you guys for listening to Bread and Roses and the Tribunus Plebis podcast. If you liked what you heard, please consider going to Apple Podcasts and leaving a nice review, maybe 5 stars. If you're not on an Apple device or you just don't use that app, I will drop a link in the description. Thank you guys. I love you all. Thank you for listening.